May there be peace on Karak once again.
So how about we start off then by talking about, I mean, it's been quite a while since you guys have kind of worked on this series. How do you sort of feel about it being brought back to life again and things like that? How's it been kind of working with the Homeworld universe again?
Well, it's awesome. I couldn't be happier. I mean, Homeworld was our first game when we started Relic. It was we loved working on it. It was innovative and stylish, and we had a really good time working on that. And then, you know, there was Homeworld 2 as well, which it just expanded it and continued deepening the style and so on. And it's just really fantastic to come back to a sort of loved IP that that you can really sink your teeth into and get re-familiar with the style and the tone. And of course, working with the same old guys again is loads of fun.
Yeah, I'd say overall, as developers, we're super excited and really honored to come back to it. Just the response that we've gotten from fans for the media that's gone out over the last few days. We've got guys going frame by frame and picking out like the markings on some of the ships, and it's just such a cool
story. And the story trailers too, and the fans get into that. It's like they're all getting in and theorizing about, you know, who's doing what and everything. It's just fantastic. It's such a lot of fun.
Cool.
You got to sort of pinch yourself that it's all, you know, real and not an awesome dream.
So sort of like back in the day when you finished up with Homeworld 2, did you feel back then that it was kind of a world that had more going on, that it had kind of more that you wanted to do with it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, in fact, Homeworld 2 shipped with, you know, a shadow of what we wanted to do for Homeworld 2. So even back in, you know, the early 2000s, we were, you know, full of brimming with ideas and full of mustard about what to do next. So we're really excited. We're delighted that the IP got picked up by, you know, fans in Gearbox. They just love the franchise and were really excited about, you know, pushing it further. And really match made in heaven. We couldn't be happier with how that has come back and connecting with the fans again. I mean, a lot of these guys, you know, played Homeworld 1 when they were kids, you know. So I think it connects with a lot of those guys on sort of a nostalgic level. But we constantly get emails from people saying, you know, this is why I got into games, this is why I got into game design or art or whatever. And it's just, you know, it's just really rewarding and fulfilling to, to connect with people that way. It's sort of why we do this, really.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So obviously quite recently, you've released some gameplay footage and, that's more or less the first gameplay footage that we've seen of the game. We're quite close to release. So we've kind of seen that it's a little bit different from Homeworld. Could you just sort of talk a little bit about the differences and sort of the similarities and differences between how the game plays, the sort of gameplay of Deserts of Karak and the original Homeworlds?
For sure. Yeah, there was a couple of pillars of Homeworld that we wanted to make sure that we honored in gameplay. One was the concept of a mobile fleet. So there is no base building. A lot of the gameplay encourages mobility and, one second.
Go on. Sorry, carry on.
So I was saying, there were several gameplay pillars that we wanted to make sure that we honored, from Homeworld. And one of those was the concept of fleet mobility. Other RTSs or other strategy games kind of have really pitched battle lines and, really defined map control, and Homeworld is much more fluid and elastic, and we wanted to make sure that we honored that, despite the fact that we were on the ground. So in the footage, you can see a lot of the concepts like strike fighters and bombers, these units that go in, hit hard, move past, and then circle back around again. And in general, the gameplay, that's not just visuals, the gameplay requires a lot of movement and a lot of seizing of terrain and high ground to gain advantage. And all of that, we also want to make sure that didn't feel tedious. So it's smart, meaningful decisions that come every 3 to 5 seconds as opposed to barraging you and demanding you to, you know, do 5 actions per second.
Also on the pillars, we were keen to honor less about gameplay, but more about the IP itself. the story, the mood, the style, the tone, the feeling of immersion. You know, these were key pillars of Homeworld that we were really, really sensitive to, you know, recapture and push further and make it much more personal too. So Homeworld's story was, you know, super epic and biblical, and you know, you never really got close with any characters, but in DOK that'll change, and you'll get a lot more intimate with the characters and their journey. So
just riffing on that a little bit too, is there's elements of narrative. People tend to think of narrative and gameplay as a little split up, but there's elements where they bridge. And one that you can see really clearly in Homeworld is how it's the story about this big epic journey. You have limited resources, you have limited time, there's, you know, death and destruction behind you. And that comes through in gameplay in several ways. One is the concept of the persistent fleet, which we have in Deserts of Karak. So as you move into these battles, your resources are really finite. And that creates this tone and emotion of not quite desperation, but of sensitivity to what you're doing that is really unique to strategy games. And we wanted to make sure we honored that as well. Another is that the concept of a hostile environment. So in Homeworld, you're jumping into these celestial phenomenon and experiencing all these crazy things across the galaxy that challenge you within levels. And we want to make sure we have that in Deserts of Karak as well. So as you're moving from mission to mission, you'll encounter sandstorms, tornadoes, I mean, various environmental phenomenon that challenge you as a player.
Okay. So when you just talk about finite resources, you mean like you've sort of deliberately limited more than kind of is normal in RTSs, kind of how much you kind of have to spend on the units that you're producing? Is that what you mean?
More or less. I mean, you can see this in Homeworld, and I don't think we've overdone what you see in Homeworld. But yeah, the map will have finite resources. A typical kind of RTS campaign mission has the basically unlimited resources, unlimited population, you know, right off the bat. And we've taken the approach that when you come into a mission, there is a finite amount of resources. You're going to have to make a wise, calculated decision with those resources and make your play.
Okay, cool. So you mentioned a little bit about the story there and how you want to emphasize that a little bit more maybe than in sort of the previous games. Is there anything you can talk about how you've sort of tried to do that? How have you kind of tried to immerse the player and bring the story to life more? Is there anything sort of specific that you can mention about that?
Sure. So Homeworld storytelling devices were cutscene animatics that were sort of hand-painted black and white movies playing between missions, and then of course the in-game NIS sequences with the in-game units and cameras. For DOK, we took that and pushed it further. So we turned the animatics into color. We added 3D elements to the animatics. We added characters to the animatics. We also integrated animatic content into the missions themselves during NISs, so that the flow is a lot smoother and it's less binary, so that the player is sort of immersed in the content in a much more cohesive and comprehensive way, if that makes sense.
Right. So you've got kind of more story content coming through in the missions.
Yeah, and just the flow is a lot smoother. So you know there's less jarring in out and more just continuous content. We've also taken steps to sort of make sure the player never really fully comes out of the experience. So, for example, in a lot of the cutscene animatics, you go to this sort of planetary map mode, and we made sure that looked and felt a lot like the sensors manager in the game, so that, you know, you had this feeling that you were playing, as the player, you were playing the sort of, you know, tactical, strategic map mode of the game, but that the intelligence officer, who's a, you know, key story character in the game, is sort of operating this planetary level, you know, mechanism. So it's almost, you get this sense that the game is much bigger than it is.
Cool. And just going back to the kind of gameplay stuff we were talking about, how would you say that the game sort of significantly differs from the previous Homeworld games in terms of how the how the player actually plays the game. Like, for example, already, we already know it. Okay, so it's more of a 2D kind of plane, apart from like the hills and the valleys and stuff. But in terms of the actual kind of strategy and things like that, does it play very similar to the old Homeworld, or are there some differences in there?
So there's some elements that we wanted to make sure we connected, as I mentioned prior. In terms of overall gameplay pacing, Homeworld had a very slow pacing. It was a little more lean back than the traditional RTS. And we wanted to make sure that the game, you know, one thing that can happen in real-time strategy games is that you send your fleet somewhere, you send your army somewhere, and you go and you start building some units, and then you hear your fleet's under attack, and you jump to there, and the whole fleet's gone, or the whole army's gone. And it's like, well, what happened here? And the pacing of the game is so breakneck that you don't actually have time to react. So Homeworld is not that way. You do have time to react. It's much more, it feels much more like a naval battle and less of like an infantry conflict of a close nice. Quarter breaching, right, where everybody dies in 5 seconds. So we wanted to make sure that we honored that. So combat's a little bit slower, but we also wanted to inject a little more tactics into the gameplay. So thinking of things in terms of strategic is what you're looking at map-wide. It's your decisions of what sectors you want to engage in and what units you want to build versus tactical, which is more about the decisions that you make in a conflict and within a given battle, how you maneuver your units. So we did want to put a little more tactical play into the gameplay, but we wanted to do it meaningfully. We didn't want it to feel like the player is spinning plates just because the game designers are asking them to.
Right.
So one of those is terrain that I mentioned before. So if you have the high ground in an engagement, you have a really dramatic advantage. And it's all organic. As you can see in some of the gameplay footage, it's not tiered plateaus. So if I secure high ground, you can push further up on a hill or an adjacent hill, and then that gives you high ground. Another thing that you can do is break line of fire with dunes. So if you have a shot on me, I can pull back behind some terrain, and that'll block your shot. And then the individual units themselves as well have a good amount of tactical decision making. The best example that I think you can see in some of the gameplay videos that's come out is the smoke screen. So we have the armored assault unit, which is kind of a armored wedge that is going to break enemy forces. It pushes up, very tough unit, but it takes a lot of damage from long range units like railguns. And those units are pretty flimsy, but they have incredible range and very high damage. So if an armored assault group is caught off guard by a group of railguns, you're almost empirically going to lose. However, there's lots of different ways that you can soften that, and that's what we find really interesting is you can build these kind of strengths and weaknesses to units, but the really fun thing is how you end up softening it and kind of manipulating that. So in the case of this relationship, the armored assault unit can throw down a smoke screen, use that to kind of leapfrog to the opposing unit, or to the opposing railguns, or they could use it to back off and secure terrain and come up for a flank, and there's just all kinds of possibility space there that we find.
Okay. Really. So you've got kind of lots of these units with sort of special abilities and things like that.
Special abilities and roles that encourages the player to use them in interesting ways. But we're being very sensitive that we don't want the player to, you know, accelerate up to 300 actions per minute because the pacing is so breakneck.
Having said that, though, watching an advanced player play is pretty amazing.
Yeah, for sure.
Pretty cool.
For sure.
Yeah. So in terms of kind of the multiplayer that the game offers and the balance between single player and multiplayer, could you talk a little bit about that? Is the game more single player focused, or have you got like an established multiplayer engine in there as well? That kind of thing.
Yeah, so I mean, Homeworld as an intellectual property is very much so about campaign and narrative, but one thing that we wanted to do was really emphasize the multiplayer and push ourselves on the multiplayer. We did not want it to feel like we were checking a checkbox and just delivering a feature that would die within 2 weeks of release. So we built a pretty full-featured multiplayer suite. We've got auto match, we've got custom games, we've got chat, we've got leaderboards that you get from ranks, ranked and unranked. I mean, the full suite of multiplayer features, more or less. And then we've also added, we've got support up to 6 players. And you can play that in kind of classic RTS Annihilation mode, an additional Annihilation mode called Carrier Annihilation that when the last carrier is out, a team loses, free-for-all, and then a new mode that we built for multiplayer for Distance of Kerak called Artifact Retrieval. And artifact retrieval is annihilation still applies. If you just destroy the opposing fleet, you'll win. But artifact retrieval creates objectives on the map which connect to the themes of the campaign that are these off-world technologies that you can get and secure. And by doing that, you'll gain power on your carrier, which makes the carrier much more powerful in combat. But once you hit a finite number, which is adjustable by players in a multiplayer lobby, you'll win the game. So it creates a tension where players have to control the map a little bit, but because these objectives are also fluid, you don't get pitched battle lines. You get lots of objectives moving across the map. And speaking to the concepts of fluidity and mobility that we talked about earlier, there's a lot of ebb and flow that happens in this game mode, and it creates some really interesting multi-front engagements.
Cool. Yep. So sort of balancing the multiplayer and making sure that the multiplayer is competitive and so on, that's something that you've spent quite a bit of time on.
For sure, yeah. We like I said, it was an objective for us. We wanted players to play several hundred games in multiplayer, not 50 and move on.
Okay. And how about kind of features that particularly quite serious competitive players find quite important, like recording games and replay modes and things like that? Do you have that kind of stuff?
We have a bit of that. Like I mentioned, ranked modes, leaderboard modes. In terms of recording games, we're evaluating. I don't want to make any promises, but we actually built a bit of that, and we opted not to have it at release, but we should have something shortly thereafter. Again, I don't want to promise anything on the time frame.
Okay, sure. Yeah, cool. Okay. How about we talk a little bit about kind of features allowing the community to sort of take the game further, things like modding or a map editor. Have you got any of those kind of any of those kind of things available, those kind of options?
Yeah, so the game is built in Unity. So right off the bat, players should be fairly familiar with the pipelines that we've got. I mean, there's something like 3 million registered Unity developers now. So there's a lot of knowledge base out there in terms of the engine. That said, we're also going to support that technically as best we can. So we'll be on the forums. We'll have some engineers there that should be able to answer any questions that people have. But it will require the folks that are modding to kind of roll up their sleeves, get into the engine. But yeah, we're going to support it, answer questions as best we can.
Okay.
We also are not planning on putting any legal blockages in front of people unless the game is being abused or other people's experiences are being violated. Namely, if somebody builds a map hack, we're going to do something about it. But.
Okay, sure. Yeah. So you would consider yourself to be sort of a pro modding developer then?
Well, we're going to support it. It depends on how the community grows. If we see a lot of activity in modding, then we'll look at releasing some tools and adding some additional support for players. But initially, it should be moddable. Players should be able to get in and experience it, and then we'll support that as best we can.
It's probably worth pointing out the Homeworld community, as it exists today, is already pretty mod-friendly and pretty active there. So we've definitely not forgotten about that and keep it. On that.
Okay, cool. Does the game the game is going to ship with some kind of map editor and things like that, presumably?
We actually won't be shipping with a map editor, but as I said, we'll support modders that are going in and editing, and we'll evaluate releasing an editor later if necessary.
Okay, cool. So I guess one of the things that sort of imminently clear to anyone who watches the gameplay footage of kind of all your games, really, but particularly Deserts of Karak, is that you obviously place quite high value on sort of graphical splendor. And by that, I don't just mean the quality of the graphics, but it's very visually appealing, like the colors and the sort of brilliance of the colors and things like that. Is that something you spend a lot of time on? Is that something that's quite important to you? And sort of how have you kind of developed that?
Yeah, I mean, for sure, it's super important to us. Blackbird was founded by, a couple of artists as well as Iggy, our CTO. So, art has always been a big, inspiration for us. We definitely spent a lot of time on the look and feel of the game. We wanted to iterate it as often as possible to get the detail and polish where we wanted to be. You know, that there's a lot of things you can do wrong with when pushing a style. So we spent a lot of time trying to just, you know, to get it right. I mean, Homeworld was in space and it had these, you know, colorful backdrops and skies. And we wanted to try and capture that on the ground as much as possible. So, you know, we have different times of day. We have mornings, noon and night. We have sunsets. We have glorious shadows. And like Rory said earlier, there's a lot of different weather effects and sandstorms and lots of things. So, yeah, we definitely spent a lot of time working on that. You know, in particular, one big challenge for us was the terrain. So like Rory mentioned before, there's a great deal of terrain gameplay. And, you know, we didn't want to just plop down terrain and call it a day. We wanted to make sure this terrain felt real and felt vast, and that you really had a sense of the character of the planet Karak. So, you know, we were heavily inspired by Google Earth, and you know, early in the development, we'd spend time in Google Earth and zoom in on the big deserts of Earth, and we'd look at places like Namibia and, you know, the Gobi Desert, and we'd find these great big sand dunes and canyons, and, you know, we'd see how the rocks and the sand were working together. We'd look at the color palettes, we'd look at the way lighting would affect them, and we built a terrain system so that, you know, the artists could really create worlds that you could really believe went outside the boundaries of the playable area and off into this vast desert. So that was a big challenge. It was definitely not easy to just bang out the terrain and call it a day and sort of high five and get on with the next thing. Like the terrain was a big deal for us, and we put a lot of time and effort into getting it right.
Cool. Sounds very interesting. Yeah. So the kind of style of the game that we've seen so far has all been kind of deserty stuff, which I suppose would make sense given the title. Are there any kind of other backdrops that we haven't seen yet that you can sort of talk about?
Yeah, there are, but I don't think we should really talk about them. You know.
Okay.
Yeah, suffice to say that it should feel like Homeworld. I mean, it's going to be it's definitely a journey. It's a road trip.
Okay.
It's an adventure, and you get that beauty and splendor that you would expect on a glorious road trip and
okay.
adventure. So yeah.
Okay, cool. So, I mean, the RTS genre in general, I mean, it's a genre that these days, it's quite difficult to have a lot of success in RTS these days in general. I mean, a lot of like big franchises have struggled. There was the Command & Conquer game that they tried to bring out a while ago, and that sort of fell flat. And, you know, really it's a genre that's sort of dominated by very big titles, very big companies backing them, like StarCraft II and so on. And it can be tricky these days to sort of establish, you know, a good game in that genre. What kind of things, I mean, why do you think that Deserts of Karak will find that kind of success? What sort of features do you think it have that that make it kind of a game that will survive in this kind of environment?
Well, you know, I mean, everyone's got a different opinion. I mean, I think players are looking for a new experience. They're looking for an immersive, engaging experience. You know, my personal opinion is that I think that there's a lot of room in the market for the genre to grow and be innovative. I personally find it an interesting genre of gameplay. You know, what we've done, I think, is to set ourselves apart, to stand apart from the crowd, is, you know, really develop a tone, a feel, a unique style and story that you know, it's its own thing. It's apart from the crowd. And, you know, fingers crossed people like it. I mean, you know, sometimes when you do something different, it's just a fizzer. And, you know, it's different and like naff, you know. but we're hoping that DOK will come out and be unique to people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I personally, I think this was a great year for RTSs. We saw some really cool titles, and I'm really, as a player, I was really excited over this last year. But yeah, for us, I mean, I think the key things in the market is to make something good, one, and then make something that feels unique and feels special. And I think we've done both those here. So I'm actually far less worried about it.
Cool.
Yeah, there's a lot of room to grow in that as well. Sure. I mean, I think there's a lot of interesting ways you can push the genre. And, you know, I think we'll see what happens.
Yeah, and I guess from what I can tell, like one of the ways that you seem to be doing that, or you seem to be trying to do that, is this kind of greater involvement in the story. Is that right?
For sure, yeah. I mean, you know, like Rory said before, Homeworld, one of the big pillars of Homeworld was its narrative, and people, you know, were really, really enjoyed that part of the property. So for this, definitely the story is a big part of it.
Okay, so just talking about the development so far, is there any particular part of the DOK development so far that you've enjoyed the most? What sort of things have you kind of enjoyed working on?
Can I answer this one first?
Please, please.
You know, I mean, to be honest, really, Rich, the thing that I've enjoyed the most is just, I mean, beyond the fact that it's Blackbird's first game, which is, of course, always special. So it's fun to build a studio and to grow a team. But, you know, and that's always got its own challenges and adventures and good times. So that's a fun thing regardless of the project. But with this particular project, it's sort of extra special because it's Homeworld. It's this favorite IP of ours from before. It's a style we were so keen on the style of Homeworld that we were actually Blackbird was actually founded very much inspired by the Homeworld style. It's a science fiction game. It was set on a desert planet. I mean, we really just love this stuff. You know, we just can't get enough of it. We're all fans of Star Wars. We're fans of you know, aliens and you know, this, you know, the old you know, sci-fi book covers from the 70s of, like, you know, Chris Foss and Peter Elson. I mean, this is a look and feel we just love. So, you know, I mean, for me, just building a studio from scratch and just working on this old familiar lovely thing is great. It's like Cambit said in the development video, it's a great blend of old and new.
Yep. Cool. And Roy, do you have anything to add to that?
The working within the Homeworld space, I mean, we have a number of guys that worked on the original, and those that we've added that are new, we're all fans. We're all deeply moved by working on this and honored to work on this. But it's also challenging as well, for sure. It's every feature, every turret type that we put on a unit, every environment, we measure it against whether or not we feel it fits the Homeworld space. And I think for players that are casually familiar with it, they'll think, oh, you know, it's a game about ships in space or something. But for fans, the possibility space is actually very, very small. The voiceover that you would expect in a Homeworld game has to have a certain tone. The ship design, that you see, the colors that you see, literally everything has a possibility space that's really narrow. And making sure that we dialed that in was something that we wanted to make sure that when the game came out, we were all happy that we had our name on it.
Alrighty. Okay, guys. I mean, that's pretty much all the questions I've got, unless there's anything you particularly want to mention or talk about.
Gosh, no, that's pretty much it. I mean, I guess the only other thing I would mention is that I just think it's sort of mind-blowing how fortunate we are at Blackbird to have had this opportunity. I mean, it was really kind of a divine intervention that, you know, that this happened. I mean, here we were working on hardware, and suddenly the Homeworld property becomes available. I mean, you know, we had nothing to do with THQ going bankrupt, you know what I mean? And, like, there they go, they're going down. You know, the property becomes available from the bankruptcy proceedings, and then it gets picked up by fans who, you know, we knew Gearbox, but we didn't know them very well at the time. And when we hooked up with them, you know, everyone was wondering, you know, what's going to happen. And when we met them, they were just like lovers. I mean, they were just gushing with mustard to do this thing. And, and it really blew our minds, and we were really taken aback, and they've just been awesome throughout the development. I mean, I've been making games for a while now, and this is kind of unique in my experience of working with a publisher. You know, they've been just super supportive, and I mean, at the risk of sounding sort of like, you know, gushy, I got to say, I mean, they've been really fantastic, and they care about the IP, they care about the fans, and they've been incredibly supportive. So we're just extremely lucky.
Okay. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, that's about it. Yeah, it's just sort of like a bit of a mind blow that it's
It's sort of like it came from nowhere. Like you weren't really expecting.
Yeah, I mean, hanging out with Paul Ruske, our music composer. I mean, he just loves chatting about this stuff. I mean, he's like, you know, I can't believe it. You know, I can't believe it. It's just like, you know, it was like destiny. You know.
Yeah.
So. And it's hard not to get misty-eyed about this sort of thing. I mean, for real, it's pretty wild.
Right. Yeah, like the series could have easily come to an end, but it didn't.
Oh, for sure, man. Yeah, it could have come to an end. It could have been bought by someone who just wanted to sit on it. I mean, but it didn't. The fans were out there. The community's out there. And, hopefully we're going to give them something that they're excited about again.
Okay.